Okay, so we were talking just before class about my message about the rework. The in-class students do have opportunity to work more on the reworked exam and turn in another version of it. So if there were things you felt you didn't completely grasp in your rework, take some more time and then turn in a revised version. So for the we have a number of people who aren't here right now. So if you're friends with them, just make sure that they learn about that. Secondly, I did send a message about. I noticed on a lot of solutions to problem one, people computed means and then took half the distance between the means, which would have been okay if those were two Gaussian distributions, but those weren't Gaussian distributions. So I want to make sure that people understand that all that work we did on distance between the means and things was specific to Gaussian distributions, which isn't bad. I mean, there's a lot of good things about Gaussian distributions, but it wasn't the more general case of that theory. And I think on the hidden Markov model problem, I think most people are kind of have figured out most of it. So that just took a little bit of practice. So today what I want to do is to take a sort of general look at a problem we call machine learning. It's actually very closely related to what's often now called statistical learning theory. To talk about a few basic concepts. So this lecture will be pretty abstract because we'll be talking about theorems and things, but I just want to introduce you to a few of these important theorems that describe characteristics of good learning machines. So we'll talk a little bit about Occam's razor and the principle embodied in Occam's razor. Then we'll talk about this something called the no free lunch theorem, which talks about the quality of learning algorithms, and then we'll talk a little bit about minimum description lanes. And I probably should take up today's class. If not, we'll start a little bit on bias and variance. But by the end of this lecture, you should have a better appreciation for why taking a data set and building subsets from that data set, processing those subsets, and then merging the learning machines that you get from those subsets, why that might be a good approach and why that might give you better performance and good generalization than just processing the data set as a whole. And we'll talk about a few techniques that allow you to do that. So in this class, we've discussed a wide variety of algorithms, and there are many, many different kinds of classification learning algorithms to choose from. Which one is best? That's a very important question because I think typically as you go through graduate studies, you tend to take a view that there is the single best algorithm or one algorithm is better than the other. What we want to do today is to give you an appreciation for how application-specific, that those kinds of judgments tend to be. And algorithms, generally, there's no one that's better than the other. It really comes down to specifics of the application. So are there any reasons to prefer one algorithm over another? That's another question that we might want to ask. And even within a given application, that's an important question. We've learned by now that you can't simply choose one algorithm over another based on one experiment, based on one data set, because there's some probability that the result you're seeing is specific to that data set. And we'll talk a little bit more about the implications of that. Now, one of the very important principles that comes from information theory is something known as Occam's razor, and we've talked about this and alluded to this many times throughout the semester. In a nutshell, what Occam's razor says is that if the performance of two algorithms on the same training data is the same, choose the simpler algorithm. And what's our motivation for doing that? Okay, and why do we think that the simpler algorithm has a better generalization properties? Entropy? What about entropy? Entropy decrease is good. Decrease in entropy means you remove uncertainty. That's a good thing. So if you have a collection of data and you, some arbitrary data, let's pick your favorite data set, stock market prices, ages of students in the classroom, whatever, and you fit a Gaussian distribution to that data and you fit some other distribution, a triangle distribution or a gamma or whatever, whatever you... Why do we prefer the Gaussian distribution? Okay, and can we, if I knew nothing about entropy, can you explain that in layman's terms? That's closer. That's about halfway there. Can we expand on that? So before you came in, someone offered up the idea that maximizing uncertainty was a good thing, and that if we minimize the entropy, that was a bad thing. But that's actually not quite the case. I mean, if you minimize the entropy, that means you actually have perfect prediction, you could say. There's no uncertainty in the data. But there's a key component to this, and that's really what the topic of today's lecture is about. So we have this sample of some kind of unknown or true distribution. Let's say the ages of students at Mississippi State, the ages of undergrads and grads. We don't really know what this true distribution is. And we'd like to, our goal is to estimate that as closely as possible. So what I do this morning is I say, well, let me take the students in this classroom, let me compute the distribution, and then let me fit either a Gaussian or a triangle distribution to that data. Why would we prefer the Gaussian fit to that data in that case, even though for this particular classroom, the triangle distribution might actually give a better fit? I don't know if that's the case, but let's assume that. Okay. Expand on that. That's good. That's close. Well, I want to be able to apply it to the whole student population. Okay. Applying it to another class is actually a similar problem that's also equally interesting. But I want to apply it to the whole university as a whole. Why? And let's think specifically about this application. I want to estimate the distribution of ages across the whole university, the students, and I'm using this particular class to estimate that because this is the data that was given to me. My professor came to me and said, here, data from my graduate class. Data from my graduate class. Let me estimate the distribution. What's going to be wrong? Everyone could be older. So what's wrong with the sample that I'm given in this class? It's not sufficient. It doesn't characterize the overall distribution. So if I fit a really complicated distribution function to that data, I'll get a really good fit on that data, but there's no guarantee that that model will be a better model for the whole population at large. So that's sort of the essence of why Occam's razor is so important, that we recognize that any given training data set is not a perfect model of the actual underlying true distribution. So we prefer algorithms that are simpler because they have a chance at giving us better generalization. And in the case of the Gaussian distribution, it has just a mean and a variance, simplest model that you can have. So more than likely, that will give us better modeling over all possible sample sets that I could draw. So if I computed Gaussian models from each and every class at the university, any one of those classes might be a poor model of the overall distribution. But on the average, that Gaussian model would produce less error from the true distribution than if I tried to compute, like I said, triangle distribution or some more complicated shape. So that's essentially why simpler or smoother classifiers generalize better. This notion of maximum entropy really is important when you want to think about generalization. So in some fields, basic laws of physics or nature, such as conservation of energy, provide insight. If you follow, for example, particle physics, there's been a lot of talk recently with the new Hadron Collider in Switzerland about what they're going to discover with this new collider. And if you follow this a little bit, what you realize is that a lot of these fundamental, they essentially predict the existence of particles. And the reason they can do that is because they have some underlying fundamental assumptions about the way physical systems behave. And a very important principle are things like conservation of energy. And so in problems like that, you could say, real-world constraints that ultimately drive your solutions or your models. The question we want to ask today is, are there analogous concepts in machine learning? Are there some fundamental concepts like conservation of energy that guide our ability to develop and learn algorithms or learn parameters of algorithms? So the Bayes error rate is one such example. The Bayes error rate gives us a theoretical bound on the error rate for a classification task, and it's based on statistics of the application. But the Bayes error rate is mainly of theoretical interest and is rarely ever known in practice. Why? What are the things that we require to know to compute the Bayes error rate? Exactly. You have to know something about the priors. You have to know something about the joint distributions and all these kinds of things that we don't generally know about an actual application. And the minute that we start modeling those or approximating those, then already our Bayes error rate estimate is essentially an approximation. So the Bayes error rate is useful, however, because we can actually create simulated data where we know the statistics, and we can then develop algorithms that demonstrate some kind of optimal behavior on that simulated data, and we can then talk about the performance of those algorithms relative to the Bayes error rate. We can also sometimes, in many applications, we'll do what are called oracle-type experiments where you try to give the algorithm more knowledge than it would normally have. You sort of ask questions like, if you knew a key piece of information, what would the performance of the algorithm be, even though you might not know that key piece of information in practice? So in this section of the course, we seek mathematical foundations that are independent of a particular classifier or algorithm. And that's, I think, a fairly new area of pattern recognition or machine learning. There's been a lot of work, a lot of literature, a lot of research done in the past 10 years or so, and some very interesting developments in this general theory, and where you're looking at bounds, you're looking at properties of all algorithms, not just properties of a particular algorithm. Unfortunately, from a sort of graduate student point of view, you may not find this so interesting, because typically as graduate students you're interested in specific algorithms or specific techniques. But this is important because these kinds of understanding of these kinds of high-level principles will really form the basis for your dissertations and things like that. So we'll specifically, by the end of this lecture, discuss techniques such as jackknifing or cross-validation that can be applied to any algorithm. And the properties of these algorithms, or the motivation for these algorithms, comes from a general understanding of the basic sort of algorithm-independent principles. Even though the algorithms themselves will seem rather obvious, but they're motivated from understanding of this issue of properties of algorithms that are independent of particular algorithms. So, you've heard me say this many times throughout the class, but now I will formally state it, and therefore you're held to this forever. So if I pop in on your dissertation defense someday, remember I'm going to bring that up. So no pattern classification method is inherently superior to any other. It is the type of problem, prior distributions, and other application-specific information that determine which algorithm is best. Every algorithm is designed to work typically to solve some specific problem very well. But no algorithm is uniformly better than any other algorithm across all applications. Now that's like I said earlier, that's a startling kind of revelation, right? Because as graduate students, you tend to think you're taking all these classes and at the very end, you will be told what the best algorithm is. And certainly, professors have their favorite algorithms and their favorite topics and things like that. But this is a very important thing to remember when you're trying to do good research in this area. Now, can we develop techniques or design guidelines to match an algorithm to an application and to predict its performance? That's another very important question. So, when we recognize that the performance of an algorithm or the ranking of an algorithm is going to be application specific, can we develop ways to predict the performance of an algorithm on a particular application without actually having to build that algorithm? Another question is, can we combine classifiers to get better performance? And this latter question, this was another hot area in artificial intelligence in the 80s. People were talking about taking a lot of poor algorithms, combining them, taking hundreds or thousands of poor algorithms, combining their outputs, and producing very good algorithms. That doesn't quite work, because very often the individual algorithms share, their performance is attributes of their performance are shared. So what I mean by that is that two algorithms may fail on the same subset of data, or they may share a large subset of data for which they both fail. So if you combine those two, obviously you're still going to have a subset of data for which you fail. The idea is if you keep adding algorithms, you'll reduce that subset of data that these algorithms share for which they fail. But when you do that, you have to find algorithms that are significantly different from the previous algorithms in your set. And very often, all algorithms that we tend to deal with are of kind of the same class. So you find as you start adding more and more algorithms, you very quickly get to a point of diminishing return. So that didn't quite pan out that way. However, I will tell you that in state-of-the-art research, if you look at, for example, state-of-the-art in an area like speech recognition, we can talk about the core algorithm, hidden Markov models. We can talk about maximum likelihood-based hidden Markov models. We can talk about discriminatively trained hidden Markov models. And maybe later in the semester we'll talk a little bit about that latter topic. But then if you look at the actual state-of-the-art algorithm, there's probably 90-95% of that algorithm consists of things like jackknifing through the data or different ways to bootstrap various training processes. That makes often a bigger difference than the algorithm itself. And then also, if you look at how state-of-the-art performance is achieved, very often it's done by combining lots of different recognizers. So in one year, when we went to an extreme on this, I remember I was at a conference, and the winning system for that evaluation that was presented ran 150 different speech recognizers and combined the outputs of those recognizers to get their overall best performance. And those 150 different recognizers that they ran were a combination of different steps in the training process. So they started with a base system, and then they refined it, and they branched off of it and refined those branches, and then they essentially took all the different outputs, which totaled about 150, and combined those to produce their final answer. And there's actually some good statistical techniques for how you combine classifiers, but this process of combining classifiers tends to give you very small increments in performance in most applications I've seen. So I've never personally been interested in this. I actually forbid my graduate students to work on that when that topic became popular a few years ago, much to their chagrin. But in any event, there are ways to combine classifiers to make sure that you're statistically getting the best of both classifiers or multiple classifiers. And we'll talk about some of those a little bit later. So, what's really been happening in the past 10 years or so with this area known as statistical machine learning, or statistical learning theory, is that we've developed a probabilistic model of learning itself. And I think this is very important because I think throughout your careers, if you 40 years from now, when you look back over your careers, I believe you're going to see a lot of the work was done actually on understanding the process of learning. I think learning is a very fundamental to the direction and the way research is going these days. What's happening now is we're sort of developing a mathematical formulation for the problem of learning. So today we'll look at a probabilistic model of learning. If one algorithm outperforms another, it is a consequence of its fit to the particular problem, not the general superiority of the algorithm. That's just restating what we discussed on the previous slide. Thus far, we have estimated performance using a test data set which is sampled independently from the problem space. This approach has many pitfalls, since it is hard to avoid overlap between the training and the test set. That's a rather obvious statement, but I can tell you, time and time again, you find that test sets are not independent samples of the problem. For example, in speech recognition, generally one way we try to make the sets independent is that we try to make sure that the speakers who appear in the training data do not appear in the test data. Now that's a pretty good guideline, but it's not uncommon when you go through a finite size data set to find out that the exemplars in your test set that are causing you problems are things which are poorly represented in your training data set. So an example of that that we encountered many years ago was we worked on a large data set at the time, but today it's considered a small data set. It's actually a data set of people speaking numbers, digit recognition. And we got on that data set, we got down to the point where performance was less than 1% error. There were actually seven, with our very best system, there were seven tokens that were causing us errors out of, tens of thousands of tokens. Four of those tokens came from a person with a very strong Southern accent. And that Southern accent was not well represented in the training data. So you realize a couple things. One, how am I going to improve performance on those Southern accents if they aren't represented in the training data? There's no chance, really, for my machine learning algorithm to learn that kind of information. But on the other hand, once I solve the Southern accent problem, then there's going to be some other accent that's going to cause me similar problems. And then there's going to be non-native speakers of English. So then you take all the languages of the world and how they would, you know, how they try to articulate English. And so then you realize the problem is just sort of immense. So that's one example. Now, a similar example happens often in, I was working, in fact, a problem earlier this semester where I was able to get very good performance on a test set, not because the algorithm was so good, but because there was a systematic difference in the channel conditions between the test set and the training set. So it was easy to pick out this particular class in the test data because its channel condition was always different than channel conditions for the other class that I was testing against. Now, that was not intended, but that was just a byproduct of the way the data was collected. A third example of this also sort of comes from speech recognition literature, but it also, you see this in any kind of data mining application. If you typically, you'll spend a number of years developing a really big, good quality training set. So let's say we go out on the internet and we take a snapshot of the internet today. And we build, you know, a billion-page database of how, let's say, the properties of text as it appears on the Internet. And we build some really nice statistical models on this, and we do research for several years. And then we come to a competition 5 years from now, let's say, and all of the best research groups get together. Some independent testing agency like NIST goes and collects text data for that competition, and then we're all given this test data, blind evaluation, and we're allowed to run on it. We all run on that data, and we get terrible performance. And we're all upset. Why? On old data, old in what sense? If we're talking about understanding, for example, text on the internet. The topics that are going to be of interest, the highest interest topics, aside from the usual ones like sex and whatnot, you know, the things that the world events and things like that that tend to shape the hot topics on the internet will be completely different 5 years from now. So if you build a machine learning algorithm based on data today and you try to recognize data 5 years from now, you're going to have problems because there'll be a difference in the data. Now, that's a two-way problem. That can be a bad thing, like I just described, or that can be a good thing if someone said, well, okay, let me reformulate the problem. Let me take a test set as a sample of data from each year. So I'll take a test set from this year, the year, next year, the year after. Well, and then you build some pattern recognition algorithm and you get very, very good performance. Well, why is that? Well, those test sets are going to have a systematic bias because of the time that they were collected. And if you can somehow key on that bias, and of course, that's what people would do if you pose such a scenario, researchers are smart enough to say, well, I'll go and get some other data from the same year when I expect that test set to have occurred. And then you can build models that kind of match these up. But if your test set has a systematic bias that results from the way it was collected, you can get an artificially good level of performance because of that. This particular problem is very, very common in the biometrics area where you're trying to assess the user's identity either through by voice or fingerprints or image. This kind of systematic bias comes up all the time. And you find out that your ability to recognize a subject on this database is more a function of the fact that the when that person was recorded, their conditions were a little different than the other people in the data. It's more a function of that than your actual ability to do the test. So, you know, this may seem like an obvious statement, but I can tell you that time and time again, I see data sets that are not constructed in a fair fashion and have some kind of systematic bias, that, and that contributes to better performance than you should be getting. So we've learned about methods that can drive the error rate to zero on the training set. Hence, using held-out data is important. And, you know, so certainly we've now learned why you should never use the training data or what's called a closed-set test to evaluate performance. It's okay to use closed-set testing to diagnose problems, but it's not okay to use closed-set testing to evaluate performance. So consider a two-category problem where the training set D consists of patterns X superscript I and associated category labels Y sub I is equal to plus 1 or minus 1, depending on which of the two classes it is, for I equals 1 to N, generated by the unknown target function to be learned, which we'll call F of X, where Y sub I, the class assignment, is equal to F of X sub I. So X superscript I. So F is essentially our learning machine. It takes an input data and it produces a class assignment. And X's are our inputs, the training data set is D, Y are our outputs. So machine learning in its simplest form is just it's a guessing game. Can I predict what this F is? And we've learned many techniques this semester to do that. We've focused on linear techniques where this is a weighted linear combination of X's, and how you can then estimate the weights of those, that linear combination. And we've introduced some nonlinear techniques where F might be some very complicated functional mapping. Let H denote a discrete set of hypotheses or a possible set of parameters to be learned. So let H of X denote a particular set of parameters where H of X is drawn from this space H. So H are going to be essentially the parameters of our learning machine. Let P of H be the prior probability that the algorithm will produce H after training. So P of H is the probability of a particular set of parameters H. Now, in the past, you've tended to think that any set of parameters for a model are equally likely. But as we've talked about a little bit, it may be the case that there's no reason to expect this P of H to be a uniform distribution. So let's let P of H given D denote the probability that the algorithm will produce H when training on D. So that's sort of obvious refinement of this for a particular training set D. Let's let E be the error for a 0, 1, or other loss function. So E is going to be essentially an accumulation of our errors. So where have we seen this formulation before? We talked about it a little bit with relevance vector machines, but prior to that, we also looked at this kind of a representation for what types of learning machines that we discussed. So this was one of the ways that we formulated support vector machines. If you remember, the basic formulation for support vector machines included a function that output 1 or minus 1 depending on the class assignment. And then with relevance vector machines, we actually introduced this concept of this sort of probabilistic model for the algorithm parameters. And then we talked about ways to actually determine which of the parameters in the model were most critical. That was what we called automatic relevance determination. So let's first let's introduce today the No Free Lunch Theorem. And it's a funny name, but apparently that name has stuck in the literature. A natural measure of generalization is the expected value of the error given D. So we can write this as the expectation E of the error given D. Now, E, the error here, this is the error that you get given a particular data set, and that is also an average over all possible learning machines that you could build with that data set. So we can write this as a sum over all possible parameters for the learning machine and over all possible functional representations for the learning machine. And then we can also write this as a sum over the test sets of P of X, the probability of the data, times 1 minus delta of this F of X and H of X. That's just a way of expressing whether the machine got the correct choice or not, since the output is a 1 or 0 function, times the probability of the parameters given the data, times the probability of the learning machine given the data. So delta denotes a Kronecker delta function, and its value of 1 if the two arguments match, and a value of 0 otherwise. So that's just a way of accumulating the errors made by the learning machine. And these priors are essentially the probability of the learning machine or the functional mapping and the probability of the parameters of that functional mapping. The expected off-training set classification error when the true function f of x and the probability for the candidate learning algorithm is p sub x of h of x given d is, okay, so that's a bit of a mouthful, but we have the true function f of x, which we don't know, but let's assume that we might know that, and the probability for the kth candidate learning algorithm. So this k represents a learning algorithm which is going to produce a particular set of parameters, h. And we can write a probability for all the different h's that this kth learning algorithm could produce as a function of the data. Because learning algorithms in general need not produce only one solution from a data set. They could produce many solutions from a data set depending on how you initialize them, their stochastic properties, and all those kinds of things. So this is a way of representing the distribution of all possible parameters that the kth learning algorithm could have produced. So we can write E sub k, the expectation of the error for the kth candidate learning algorithm, as the error given a particular machine F and N, I think. I think N. I don't remember what N is there. I'll have to check that. I think N is the number of data points, but let me check that. And that's then just the sum of this function where we now have, that's essentially the sum of this P of X times the error times P sub K of H of X given D. So the no free lunch theorem states the following. It says that for any two learning algorithms, P1 of H given D and P2 of H given D, so these are, you'll notice now, this is a probabilistic formulation for a learning algorithm that expresses that learning algorithm in terms of the distribution of the parameters that it produces given D. So for any two learning algorithms, the following are true independent of the sampling distribution P of X and the number of training points. Now, yeah, that's why I think N is the number of training points. The independent of the sampling distribution. This is important because, remember, we want a result which is independent of the particular test data set. So this is a theorem which describes behavior that's independent of a particular data set, X, P of X. Uniformly averaged over all target functions, F, these expected errors, E1 minus E2, is equal to zero. So what that means is that if you average over all possible outcomes for two particular learning algorithms, the error rate is going to be zero. The difference between the error rates are going to be zero. What is that state? Operationally, we've essentially stated this earlier in words. How would you describe this in prose? Well, we talked about on the previous slide that no one algorithm was better than any other algorithm. What is this theorem? What is this result stating? Right, so even if, so it may be that on a particular data set, one learning machine does better than another learning machine, but that's most likely just an artifact of that particular data set. And if you were to average over all possible data sets, the differences between those algorithms would go to zero. Now that's a very significant result, because in the back of your mind, you're thinking, support vector machines, great technology, gotta be better than PCA. Right? But if you average over all possible data sets, there are going to be some data sets for which support vector machines do not do very well, and where PCA will do better. So, you know, averaging out across all data sets, the difference is zero. Now, like all theorems, you take this with a grain of salt, because of course we never are able to average over all possible data sets for an application. Second, for any fixed training set D uniformly averaged over F, the expectation of E given and E given F and N, E1 given F and N is minus E2 given F and N is equal to zero. So that's essentially saying that that if I average over all possible functional mappings, F, I'm going to get zero also. Uniformly averaged over all priors, P of F, the difference between these two expectations is also zero. And then for any fixed training set D uniformly averaged over P of F, those differences are also zero. So the no free lunch theorem is just a formal way of stating that the difference in algorithms on a specific data set is likely to wash out when you average across all possible data sets. Now that's not to say that you shouldn't look for a better algorithm on a particular problem. It's just this is trying to give an algorithm independent, data set independent view of the machine learning problem. So you could sort of, some people like to say, well, this is sort of a fundamental theorem of machine learning. It's sort of like how fundamental conservation of energy is to physics. Same kind of deal. So let's do a little bit of analysis and interpretation on this algorithm. So the first proposition states that uniformly averaged over all target functions, the expected test set error for all learning algorithms is the same. So that's just stated another way. That's just taking a sum of the difference in these errors multiplied by or weighted by the probability of the data given the function, and that's equal to zero. And stated more generally, there are no I and J such that for all f of x, one algorithm is better than another. F is the functional mapping. Further, no matter what algorithm we use, there's at least one target function for which random guessing is better. This is something that I, you know, another thing I like to emphasize, because in a lot of experiments, it's very important to establish random guessing or random guessing based on priors as an important baseline. And it'll tell you where your technology stands relative to that. But also it tells you that there is some chance you can get lucky and find a configuration of a learning machine that's better than another. So the second proposition states that if we know D, the data, then averaged over all target functions, no learning algorithm yields a test set error that is superior to any other. So we have a little bit graphic here that demonstrates this. The six squares here represent all possible classification problems. If a learning system performs well over some set of problems, better than average, it must perform worse than average elsewhere. So so that's just a way of saying that, you know, why the motivation for averaging across all possible test sets and all possible learning machines and such. Now, another thing that factors into this is algorithmic complexity. And this is a second major point that I like to stress. There's no reason to expect an algorithm that is more complex. I mean, it is reasonable to expect that an algorithm that is more complex will do better than an algorithm that is less complex. So if your new proposed algorithm has more parameters, it's got, you know, on the average, it's expected to do better. If you want to prove the superiority of an algorithm, you have to look at it with the same complexity, the same number of parameters. And number of parameters is not necessarily equivalent to complexity, but it's a good guideline. Complexity is a slightly more abstract notion that reflects sort of the mathematical flexibility, you could say, of the learning machine. So can we find some irreducible representation of all members of a category? Algorithmic complexity, which is also known as Kolmogorov complexity, seeks to measure the inherent complexity of a binary string. Now, why is that concept interesting to us? What are some applications where we've used that concept? So you might have seen this in computer science when you've talked about things like Turing machines. You might have seen this in compression when you've talked about what's the minimum possible bit rate that you can achieve for a signal or a data set. Complexity factors in a number of ways. If a sender and receiver agree on a mapping or compression technique, the pattern X can be transmitted as Y and recovered as X equals L of Y. The cost of transmission is the length of Y, and that's one of the basic components of complexity theory. Is we're going to assume that that the cost of transmission is proportional to the length. You can obviously see in a data transmission application or compression application why that's relevant, but we can also talk about that generally in terms of learning machines. And that's why often the complexity of a learning machine is related to the number of parameters associated with the learning machine. The least such cost is the minimum length and denoted C star as the minimum of Y over this L of Y equals Y. And a universal description should be independent of specification, the programming language or machine assembly language. So the universal description, it's sort of like asking if you have a particular data set and you were to model this with a particular programming language, the complexity of the application itself should be independent of the particular programming language that you chose. So we want something that's independent of essentially the machine learning algorithm. The Kolmogorov complexity of a binary string X, denoted K of X, is defined as the size of the shortest program string Y that without additional data computes the string. So it's the minimal representation required to describe the data. And this U represents an abstract universal Turing machine. If you're not familiar with that concept, there's some pointers to it, and you can look into the computer science literature. So, and as an example, consider a string of n ones, ones occurring n times. If our machine is a loop that prints ones, we need only log 2n bits to describe the number of iterations. Hence, the complexity of that string is of the order log 2 base n. So that's a simple example of Kolmogorov complexity. It's very hard to compute Kolmogorov complexity in practice, but there are a number of sort of special cases where people have proposed bounds on the complexity. Okay, so we'll pick this up next time, and we'll talk a little bit about bias variance and jackknifing.